Today on Family Talk.
It's so easy for parents to get caught up in the day-to-day hustle and bustle of parenting and not really notice the years racing by. I'm Roger Marsh, and our guest today on Family Talk reminds us to keep our eyes on the finish line, too. Here's your host, psychologist and author Dr. James Dobson, to introduce the broadcast.
Well, hello, everyone, and welcome to Family Talk. I'm your host, Dr. James Dobson, and I have a guest today that you're going to find fascinating. He truly is a man of after my own heart. We have many similar ideas about families and about raising your children. David McElvaney is in the studio with me, and he's here to discuss his perspectives on how to build a family vision. And in his case, he did it at least in part by homeschooling his own children. Many people fail to consider what it takes to instill values and direction in a family. But David is here to talk about how to pour your family values into your children. And that's well worth a program, I would think. What is the spiritual, cultural, and ethical direction that you're trying to take your children in? How do you raise them with a healthy family identity? And yes, how do you prepare for a future where values and family are going to be torn down from every angle? The culture is just doing everything it can to destroy them. Christ asked his disciples, "What does it profit a man to gain the whole world and lose his own soul?" And that same question is at the heart of David's approach to family life and family vision. He and his wife, Mary Catherine, have four children. You were very close to your dad, especially in the very early days, weren't you?
Very close. We traveled the world together for his business. We started with a very good relationship. That relationship broke down, I'd say catastrophically. I ended up running away from home. I spent a year away from home at a youth ranch.
At what age?
14.
At age 14. You just took off.
I did.
And did he not know where you were?
That episode lasted about 30 days, and then they sent me off, first to a drug rehab. They weren't sure what was going on in my life, so they just thought, as they were grasping for straws, let's try to solve a problem, any problem, all of the problems. Let's get some professional
help. But you were not a druggie.
No. I mean, honestly,
you did not take drugs.
I had marijuana once, and I had probably too much to drink at that age, certainly. But in terms of being strung out on drugs, no. It was experimental at most.
And they sent you to a rehab facility.
When communication breaks down and parents don't have the information that they need to make the clearest possible decisions, sometimes they feel it's just important to make a decision, and that's what got put in motion. And, you know, after that, they sent me to a youth ranch, a Christian home in Arkansas, where I spent almost a year. And, you know, it's an interesting story. The first several weeks I was at that ranch, in a very strange twist of fate, I was responsible for feeding the pigs and cleaning out the pig troughs.
You were prodigal.
Indeed.
And you got up and you came home?
You know, after about 11 months, I asked my parents when, if not now. And they gave me a 27-page document to sign, which was sort of the rules of the road. And that's the same document that I had rejected earlier. And the reason why I ended up at the youth ranch, because they weren't going to have me back if I wasn't going to follow the rules. And I don't think that my heart was any softer in that moment, Dr. Dobson, but I expediently wanted to get home. So I signed the document and got home. What really changed my heart was a few months later, getting in big trouble. I sat down with my dad at the Waffle House and he confronted me on something. And I knew that I'd be going back to the ranch until I was 18. And instead, through tears, he looked at me and he said, "David, I forgive you. I'm disappointed, but I forgive you." And I remember sitting there with cheese eggs and cinnamon toast, thinking to myself, "What have I done? Why am I doing this?
Did Everything he has ever to change." Ask you, "Do I need to ask you to forgive me?"
You know, that was a process that unfolded over the next 5 to 6 years. And, you know, we started with a good relationship. It broke down utterly. And the healing process began that day at the Waffle House. But the healing process, and it is a process, it took years. It took years.
Do you remember what the issue and what the problems were that caused the relationship to break down at 14 years of age? Other than being a smart alecky adolescent who experiences the usual challenge to authority.
Clearly, two things. One was when I was 11, my grandfather died, and he went in for a very normal procedure, and we just prayed for him that everything would go well, and the next day he's dead. And my mother was absorbed with her grief, and my dad was tending to her, and I didn't know what to do other than say, God, why did you do this? Because I prayed, and of course, I'm an 11-year-old. You don't necessarily have a complex theology about prayer and how God interacts with you and the purpose of prayer. And but I was angry. So that was the first thing, is I was angry with God on the basis of a disappointment in prayer. The second thing is the disappointments that I experienced sort of repeatedly with my father, and that related to his travel schedule. He was running a business that required that he travel to Europe and to South Africa, and he'd be gone for long stretches of time, 2, 3, 4 weeks at a time. And you know, the number of hockey games or soccer games that I'd look over and see the other kids' parents there, but not my dad, that created wounds. And I think those two things made a soul structure that for me was fairly frail. So
yeah, you needed him at that time, didn't you?
Yeah.
Jumping way over to today and your family, you have attempted to avoid that same problem in that you travel a lot today. You're all over the world because you're handling the business that your dad started. And you have a policy in your family about your time away from home. You want to share it?
Sure. You know, it's a multi-generational family business now. And as we just described, it might not have been had those events not sort of found a healthy resolution. And they did. But I realized that travel, although it's vital to my business, may be detrimental to my family. So our rule is that if I'm going to travel more than 3 days, one of the kids comes and travels with me. And then if I travel more than 7 to 10 days, the whole family comes. And that's not an easy thing to pull off, which does sort of limit the kinds of obligations I'm willing to make, the commitments I'm willing to make. But when it does happen, the family goes with us. You talk about a letter that you received from your father in your book on legacy, where he says one of the most dangerous delusions that we have is to suppose that the gospel is going to be made obvious to our kids. We have to make it obvious to them. We have to be there. And you know, in that context, I remember you describing the transition that you had to make professionally, realizing the high cost and consequence if you didn't. Being encouraged by your father to do so. But you listened, you responded, and you set a different trajectory for your legacy.
Now, you're a busy businessman, a successful businessman, and you travel a lot. How do you preserve that time with your kids that you're talking about?
It means that we say no to a lot of things. It means that the outside commitments that can infringe upon family time, we've made a decision that we're not going to do. And there may be future ramifications from that. I'm not saying that what we're doing is in any way ideal. It works for us. And I just want to value and preserve the time that we have as a family because honestly, we will blink and our kids will be gone. I've got a 10-year-old, an 8-year-old, a 5-year-old, a 3-year-old, and I can't
believe it. It's amazing how fast.
We're over half done with our oldest. Yeah. And I just want to make sure that we have every moment, every conversation, and the important conversations, Dr. Dobson, I hope we have them 10 or 15 times, 20 times, so that again, it's in their minds and in their hearts, the things that they should care most about, the values that we want to convey. The reality is when you think about legacy, it's not just something that you leave at the end of your life. It's something that you're cultivating all along the way. It's the sum total of the individual choices that you're making towards your highest goals and expectations.
Now, I want to help our listeners see where you're coming from. You have taken over your father's business, and it has three components to it. I'm saying this because it relates to my question. The McIlvaney Financial Group, International Collectors Associates, that's precious metals, and McIlvaney Wealth Management. It's about money and wealth and helping people to manage it. How do you understand and articulate the essence of your treasure in that world?
First, receiving something from my father, a set of responsibilities. Not only did I want to manage those well, but expand upon them. And so borrowing from the idea of the talents, being given one, I want to make another one. And so we've grown our businesses on that basis. It's very important to me as we cultivate sort of the intangible side of our family resources, the heart and the mind in our home, that my kids not get confused with Dad's emphasis and focus on business and the importance that we place on transcendent treasure. And transcendent treasure is the only thing that lasts anyways. So yes, I feel responsible to my father to take what I've received and learn and grow it and develop it and do everything I can to make it better. But on the other hand, I also know that it's, in the end, wood, hay, and stubble relative to the intangible resources which I'm managing. And that's not a business. That's what happens at home.
Let's suppose that we fast forward your life about 40 years, and you're now realizing that life is short and you have a catastrophic illness. Let's suppose that you're having heart problems or cancer or whatever it is. Let's advance it even further to where you know that you only have a few days left. And you're lying there on the bed looking back across your lifetime. What will matter most to you? What's going to rise to the top and say, that's what I care about most? What's it going to be?
When you're sitting around the breakfast table or the dinner table with your kids, you're putting in motion things that will grow to maturity with God's grace, and they have to correspond to that ultimate vision that you have on the horizon. I presume my kids have been saved. On that basis, I say, if they are followers of Jesus Christ, what I would love to see for them is them living a robust life, living as mature people. Again, mature in all categories, emotionally mature, spiritually mature, intellectually mature, that they will have grown and grown and grown and continue to grow and never take for granted the gifts and talents and abilities that God has given them, the opportunities to become more like Christ. What is this that we're supposed to manage? So many families get lost in the management of tangible resources, growing a balance sheet which shows a stock portfolio, a bond portfolio. I don't want to minimize the importance of those things, but they will all be worth nothing. And what is eternal are these intangible resources that you get to manage. Oh, by the way, the clock is ticking. The clock is ticking. And if you feel like you've already missed the opportunity because your kids are grown and gone, think of your role as an uncle. Think of your role as an aunt. Think of your role as a grandparent. Reminding each of the people in your family, set a trajectory. Take the resources that you've been given, look at the good, and look at the bad. Take the baggage that you may have. Set it aside. And set a fresh course, because every generation has to do two things. One, appreciate what they've been given and the legacy vision that they've received from their parents. And you know what? Then there's a modification process, because they're unique individuals made in the image of God with a very specific and unique calling. So how do they translate the vision that they've received from you into a fresh vision that they can cast for their families?
Let me put my answer to my question in words. I think you said the same thing, but this is what I wrote. It was 1974. I was working on my book, What Wives Wish Their Husbands Knew About Women. And these are the words that flowed from my pen. I said, I have concluded that the accumulation of wealth, even if I could achieve it, is an insufficient reason for living. When I reach the end of my days, a moment or two from now, I must look backward on something more meaningful than the pursuit of houses and land and machines and stocks and bonds, nor is fame of any lasting benefit. I will consider my earthly existence to have been wasted unless I can recall a loving family, a consistent investment in the lives of people, and an earnest attempt to serve the God who made me. Nothing else makes much sense.
Amen.
And I still live by that today. I'm sure you do too, if I heard correctly what you just said.
Absolutely. And to me, it's a question as parents of almost like a curatorial work. You know, curator of an art museum is setting the stage, creating an environment. And how do you do that? You know, we talked a little bit about mealtime and what can happen there, conversations, the things that you celebrate, yeah. Getting to touch base with your kids and having sort of an emotional barometer, having family meetings, creating adventures. You know, this is not unlike what you and Ryan do when you go hunting or fishing,
yeah.
You know, where there's something that's happening that's creating family bonds and connectedness. And of course, what happens in that context is you're talking about the most meaningful stuff of life. So, you know, training your children in the gospel is not about sitting down on the couch and saying, now listen, here's what you have to believe. It's number one about living the truths of the gospel. And then in those walk and talk moments where you're living life, enjoying life with your family, then you get to speak into open hearts. And that's a beautiful, beautiful thing to experience.
Mm-hmm. You have written a story about Jonathan and Sarah Edwards and Max Jukes. Let me read your own words. I marked it because it really jumped out at me. 150 years after Jonathan and Sarah Edwards lived, this is the legacy that they left. One VP of the United States, three U.S. senators, three state governors, three mayors, 13 college presidents, 30 judges, 65 professors, 80 public office holders, 100 lawyers, and 100 missionaries. In contrast, Max Jukes, their descendants had become very well known in New York in the prison system. There were 7 murderers, 60 thieves, 50 prostitutes, 130 convicts, 310 paupers who lived a combined 2,300 years in poorhouses, and 400 offspring whose lives were destroyed by excess. That's the legacy of a good family and a family that didn't have a system of values on which to build.
It's absolutely remarkable. And, you know, to just catalog the things that are most important to you and make sure that your life reflects those values is what any mother, father, anyone can do. What are the most important things in life? And is your life on a daily basis consistent with those? I would think that if you were part of Jonathan and Sarah Edwards' family, you would feel like you were valued. You would feel like you were cherished. You would feel like you had a hope and a future. I mean, some of that ties to your introduction to Christ, and some of it ties to the discipleship process and the mentorship process which took place in the home. We have to be about that.
You also have talked about three decisions that impact the building of a family legacy.
When you look at the legacy that you've received, you have to accept it, for better or for worse. I mean, you can live in denial of what you have and what you don't have. For many of us, there's pain and tragedy which come as a part of our family history. Own it. Own it. Because realize what you have the assets and the liabilities, this is your starting point, but it's not ultimately your end destination. You have to account for where you are today as you begin your journey to where you want to go. The second part is to marry wisely. Marry wisely. The life that I live with Mary Catherine, it is remarkable, it is blessed, it is beautiful, and it could be, alternatively, distracted and full of discord, and it's not. We love each other. And the third thing is to intentionally set the course for your own legacy, to again, reverse engineer on the basis of your highest ideals of what the good life is, what it looks like to mature emotionally, spiritually, and intellectually, and begin the process of moving towards that. Everyone is going to leave a legacy. Everyone is. It just depends on what kind of legacy you're going to leave, right? If it is an intentional legacy, then it was by design. It was with some forethought. And by the way, this is not exactly a scientific process where you map things out like an engineer and it happens just so. There is grace that must abound in this context. So we put together our best plans and intentions, write them in pencil because plans do change, and then ask God to bless and guide.
You tell a story about a woman named Kim. Share it.
Kim is a good friend of ours, and her husband was brilliant, absolutely brilliant. One of the things that he had is sort of a weakness, if you will, was a sex addiction. And it caused—
Pornography, women?
Women. And it caused a major fracturing in their family, ultimately led to divorce. Kim saw this happening, and it was not retrievable. It was not— it couldn't be redeemed. And she began to plan. She began to plan to get a degree so that she could teach and she could be there for her children when they came home from school, having the same schedule that they had. She gave intentional thought and design to what needed to happen for their family life to be the best that it possibly could be in light of difficult circumstances. She was not in control of what happened to her, but she was in control of how she reacted and responded to it. And it was with great love that she put her life into her kids. Amazing to see her say, "Look, I'm not dating. I don't want to get remarried. I don't need to get remarried. I want to make sure that every hour that I can put into my kids, I do. I have the rest of my life ahead of me. But for this time in my life, I have my kids, and I want the very best for them." This is a story of tragedy. It's also a story of victory. Just because something doesn't go the way that you thought it would in life, just because you feel like you've fumbled the ball, doesn't mean there's not the next play that you put in motion, and it may be the play that takes you all the way down the field. I look at Kim and I think, as a single mom, she's a hero. She's done a better job parenting than many, you know, families that are still intact. Because of her design, her intention, her desire, her self-sacrifice, because of the intangibles that she put into the equation, I see kids who are flourishing. I see her family and her kids now grown adults, and they're alive inside. They love Jesus. This is a beautiful thing because tragedy can beget tragedy, and she didn't allow it to.
David, we only have a minute left. I know that you have written something like what I read just a few minutes ago, which is kind of a summary of what I really care about. You have done something similar to that, that you call a document. How can people get a copy of it or see it or read it?
4 pages is a small reading commitment, and I think it's enough to act as a primer for setting the context for what it is that you want. In terms of creating that legacy. If you went to davidmcilvaney.com, you can request that 4-page document. Again, it's a primer on reverse engineering your highest ideals. And that's what we've really been talking about today, the things that we care most about. How do you put them in motion right now? This is a practical way of getting started.
Good answer. Thank you for being with us, David. Thank you for sharing these thoughts about family life from the perspective of a young man. And I've enjoyed getting acquainted with you, and give your dad my regards. Your dad and mom, I know them both, and it's a pleasure to have you here today.
Dr. Dobson, thank you for having me.
And And what a great reminder that your legacy is about so much more than the financial resources you leave for your children. In fact, it is more precious than gold. You've been listening to Dr. James Dobson's Family Talk, featuring our guest, David McIlvaney. If you'd like to know more about his book, Intentional Legacy, look for a link on our broadcast page at drjamesdobson.org. You can also download the program there to listen again or to share with a friend. Now, you may remember that last week we aired a program about the documentary called Is Genesis History? Well, it was only supposed to be in theaters one night, but it ranked number one at the box office on that day and sold out auditoriums all over the country. So now there will be an encore showing tomorrow night at theaters nationwide. Go to isgenesishistory.com to get viewing information in your area. And before I sign off for the day, let me tell you about our new listener feedback line. We really want to hear from you. So call us at 844-823-2669 to leave broadcast suggestions or prayer requests or to share your own stories. Again, that's 844-823-2669. I'm Roger Marsh. Thanks for joining us today. We'll see you right here next time on Dr. James Dobson's Family Talk.
Family Talk is not associated with Focus on the Family.